Good evening. I'm John Hutchison. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this Anthony Smith Memorial Lecture, which is part of the public lecture series of the Department of Government at LSE. I'm told to say hashtag SMUHA. Before I introduce Professor SMUHA, let me just say something about Professor Anthony Smith, who is Emeritus Professor in Nationalism and Ethnicity at the London School of Economics, and who passed away last July. Anthony was a foundational figure in the study of nationalism. He produced a series of seminal books and articles which have become reference works in the field. But although there have been many eminent scholars of nationalism at the LSE itself, Ilya Kadoury, Elnor Skelner, Anthony's supervisor, and Anthony's successor, Professor John Brulé, more than anyone else, he can be said to have established nationalism as an interdisciplinary field of study. And indeed, there are very few scholars, however eminent, who could be said, as it were, to almost establish a field of study. He did this through a series of magisterial overviews of the field and through the institutions that he established, the Association for the Study of Ethnicity and Nationalism and the two journals of nationalism, Nations and Nationalism, and Studies in Ethnicity and Nationalism. Let me just say something about his scholarship. He was an outstanding scholar who wrote 18 books, which have been translated into 22 languages. His key contribution began with the Ethnic Origins of Nations, in which he developed a very influential framework for the analysis of nationalism, the so-called ethno-symbolic interpretation of nationalism, which argued that successful national formation or nation-state formation rested on the ability of the nation-state to draw on historic and cultural repertoires of older ethnic collectivities. But his publications in the field of nationalism covered an enormous range. Early on, he wrote about modernizing states. He wrote about the state system in Africa. There's a very influential article on warfare, on globalization. One of his key books was on religion, the chosen peoples. And towards the end of the life, he was increasingly interested in fields of culture. So he wrote one of his later books was on nationalism and art, based on his second PhD in art history. And his final book was Nationalism and Classical Music. A second contribution was as a great intellectual systematizer. The field of nationalism was relatively new, marked by a whole series of disparate contributions by eminent scholars from many different disciplinary backgrounds who often spoke across each other. It was his contribution to bring, through developing common definitions, common classifications, identifying common problems and issues, to bring this field into a coherent entity. A third crucial contribution was a teacher at the LSE. He established, with some others, courses in nationalism at the undergraduate level, at the MSc level, and at a doctoral level. Indeed, Professor Walker Connor stated at one point, he established the LSE as the Mecca of nationalism. Professor Learson described it, giving a lecture at the LSE was like entering Valhalla. I think a comment that rather alarmed Anthony. He was a devoted supervisor. I was his first PhD student, and he was an inspirational teacher at that level. And he'd some 32 students he successfully taught towards their doctorate, many of them in eminent positions worldwide. Above all, with his students, his band of students, he established the Association for the Study of Ethnicity and Nationalism, which over 25 years has organized annual international conferences at the London School of Economics. Aisen also established Nations and Nationalism, as well as SEN, and Nations and Nationalism, the leading journal in the field. And Anthony was its editor-in-chief, active until his final year. I think Anthony would have thought that his legacy, too, was in the achievements of his students, achievements of which he took great pride. And it's a particular pleasure to introduce Professor Sami Smuha to speak on the topic of how do Western democracies cope with the challenge of diversity. Sami is one of Anthony's oldest friends and a leading authority in comparative ethnic relations, who's developed the concept of ethnic democracy. Since, as I said, one of the themes of Anthony's work was his contention that the cohesion of nation states rested on the states having being based on a dominant ethnic core community whose culture supplied the ethos of its public institutions. It asks then a fundamental question about how nation states in the current world achieve social cohesion. Because in the contemporary world, increasingly societies are marked by cultural diversity. Diversity not only from minority nationalities, which again are increasingly asserting political rights, but also from immigrant minorities. So it's particularly appropriate then that a scholar of Professor Smuha's eminence is here to enlighten us on how to resolve this knotty problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me begin with some personal remarks. I would like to thank the organizers for choosing me to launch the Anthony Smith Memorial Lecture. I'm not sure I deserve it. It is hard to approach Anthony's stature and contribution to the study of nations and nationalism. I know Anthony for more than 25 years. He and Diana, and later their son, Josh, used to spend vacations at Haifa, where they have relatives. And I had the pleasure of meeting them and traveling together to see archaeological sites in Israel, which Anthony was very fond of. I organized in the early 2000s, I organized a series of lectures for Anthony on nationalism at the University of Haifa. And I was amazed how many people he attracted to this series. Not only people from faculty from the social sciences, but people from the humanities, from comparative literature, from cultural studies, and others. When I planned my appointment as a visiting professor at the University of London, SOAS, on top of my mind was to be close to Anthony. So it's very sad, you know, for me this evening to see that I lost him, all of us lost Anthony, but we are blessed with his heritage. Unlike many in the British and continental universities, Anthony did not reject the idea of nation and nationalism. And I think thanks to him, thanks to his balanced view of this phenomena of nations and nationalism, we, I think, better understand this phenomena. This evening I'm going to talk about how the West has dealt with diversity, ethnic diversity. Multiculturalism had been, since the 70s, the buzzword of in the West. It is an ideology, multiculturalism, which celebrates and supports linguistic and cultural differences. It is my thesis that the West reluctantly embrace and institutionalize ethnic differences. Although they oppose each other, liberalism and nationalism converge to reduce and even to eliminate ethnic diversity. So much for our introductory comments. Now let me go and to the lecture itself. Let's start with classification of human diversity. I mean, there is diversity in appearance of people, their abilities, their personalities, and so forth. And also there are more minute differences in dialects, not only in language, but in dialects, and so forth. But I'm going to speak about societal differences, differences in language, and religion, nation, culture, and so forth. I'm not going to talk about personal differences. Now, I'm sure that all of us agree that diversity is an asset. I mean, if you have diversity of talents, diversity of outlooks, diversity which really require from us to see the other and then to examine and search ourselves, our identity. So there is no doubt it is an asset, but it's also a burden. Diversity between people, I mean, people who are different, say in language, in religion, in their outlooks and so forth, have difficulty really communicating with each other, understanding each other, and hard to interact with each other. And also, we know that when diversity is appreciable, then it also breeds distance, it breeds hate of the other, a hierarchy, inferiority and superiority, and so forth. But from a sociological point of view, diversity, if you want to keep diversity, it's very costly. Because suppose that you have two communities with different languages, and they want to transmit their language and their culture to the next generation. They need separate schools. This means you have duplication of institutions, and duplication of institutions are very costly. So societies and states have difficulty maintaining diversity of institutions and of cultures. Now, this is generally speaking. But when societies or states started to modernize, then modernization became a barrier, diversity became a barrier for modernization of society. Because modernization, at least in the Western world, requires standardization of behaviors, of procedures, industrialization. If you want to produce en masse products, you need also to standardize behaviors and values of people. And again, if you want to keep differences in language and culture and so forth, this will be very costly, then you have to have double institutions. And this is very costly. So the first big barrier to diversity was modernization. Modernization called for uniformity and standardization of behavior and norms. But along with modernization in the West, we have two other very strong forces. One is liberalism, and the other was nationalism after the French Revolution. Liberalism meant in the means in the West still, it's not just historically, that you celebrate the autonomy of the individual. Liberalism means individualism, that the individuals have the right to fulfill oneself, to choose whatever he wants to do, as long as it doesn't hurt, he or she does not hurt the other. And this is against holding to any ascriptive a group, you know, ethnic group or cultural group, whatever. You have to be liberated from your group memberships, and then you do whatever you likes to do. You fulfill yourself as a person. So that's liberalism in the West. And so this is against diversity of languages and of cultures. The other force was nationalism. Now, nationalism in the 19th century in the West meant that you establish a nation state. So all the people in the state, they share together citizenship, they share common identity, but they share also one language and one culture and one way of life and so forth. So again, you have to get rid of ethnic or cultural differences in society. And so we have now three forces in the West which combine together modernization, liberalism, and nationalism against ethnic differences. But there was in the 60s, I mean the 60s of the last century, with all the success of the West in reducing ethnic differences, then there was a new emigration to the West, to Europe, and to the United States, of groups which were not assimilable. They don't want to assimilate, and they want to stick to their identity, and their cultures were not liberal. I mean, they were connected with ethnic religious groups, and they want to keep this identity, and their values were not in support of personal autonomy, individualism, and so forth. So the West, for really the first time, confront new immigrants, both in the United States, also in Europe. In Europe, there were mostly Muslims. In the United States, were mostly Latins, you know, Spanish speaking, which were very slow in assimilating. So the question is, how the West will deal with this people? The West experienced this new immigrants as a threat to its culture, and the radical right in the West uses this new immigrants to reinforce this threat. Now, let me in general now explain what are the strategies used, usually states use, not only the West, generally speaking, a strategy that states use to cope with diversity. I think we can classify this strategies into two categories. There are strategies that reduce or eliminate differences, cultural and ethnic differences, and there are strategies which maintain or accept the differences. Now, In the first category, we include, unfortunately, include genocide. When you have a mass killing of an ethnic group, you get rid of the differences by just eliminating the persons, the people. Or you can use control of a population by expelling people or not accepting immigrants which they differ from you. You accept only immigrants which are close to you ethnically or culturally. Another way of doing getting rid of differences is by partition. You partition the territory. You get rid from part of your territory in which there is another group, another ethnic group, which it's different from you. So you get rid from the territory and its population. That's another way of doing it. And maybe another way, which is it's very standard, is assimilation. You simply assimilate, and then by this way that you eliminate the differences. Now, the other category of maintaining and managing diversity is by then you accept the differences. You say we have to live with the differences, and then you accept the other group, recognize the other group, and also you share power with the other group, so that then they will be pleased with their condition as minority, or you create a federal state which is based on the differences. So it will be, say, in the state you will have one province in one language, another province with another language, and so forth. So in this way, they will share the rights and the collective rights as well. That's our, generally speaking, how states cope with the diversity. Now, when we talk generally on these strategies, let's now take the political systems which exist in the West and see how the different political systems are tied with the two strategies. Now, in the West, we are talking about democracies only. In the Western democracies, there are three types of democracies. One, which the most important one, is liberal democracies, and most of the states in the West are liberal democracies, like the United States, France, and most of the Western states. And these states are political systems which are geared to reduce or eliminate diversity. And they do it with coercive means, like genocide, or population control, or other means like assimilation. Assimilation could be also coercive. I mean, it depends. There are all different kinds of assimilation. Now, another type or another political regime is what we call consociational democracy. Sorry for this jargon, you know, from the political science. Now, consociational democracies, you can maybe use another term for it, say, binational state. You know, it's another way of saying consociational democracy. And this consociational democracy, they accept the differences and try to live with this. They built a political system that accommodate the differences, not eliminating them, but rather institutionalize the differences. And there are only very small number of Western states of this type. Switzerland, Belgium, Canada, New Zealand, and also what we have it now also from 1998 in Northern Ireland. This is what we call consociational democracy. Now, there is a third type which is not well known, which I call ethnic democracies, which they combine keeping the differences, but also keeping inequality and some kind of subordination. And some of these countries are Estonia, Latvia, and Slovakia. Okay? So we have some political systems and with different strategies of managing ethnic differences. Now, let's take now the liberal democracies and see how they, I said that they usually they reduce the differences or get rid of the differences. How do they do it in general? First of all, the dominant group impose its language and culture on the total population and present this language and culture as a national culture. You know, that is a, not ethnic culture, but it's a culture for everybody. They use the schools to transmit their language and their culture, and they use also the media to socialize the population according to their image. Now, but the most important way of doing it is by creating a society which is free and open, a society in which everyone can interact with anybody else, a society where you can choose where you live, a society you can choose your school, a society that what we call a free circulation of people. And the most important thing, that in this society they usually have civil marriage and divorce. So people can choose their partner and they can mix and intermarry, and then they can lose, after a couple of generations, they can lose their identity and their ethnic descent by being all of them to be mixed. And we see that in the West, the rates of intermarriage, the rate of assimilation is very high. For example, in the United States, the rate of intermarriage is over 50%, even for Jews in the United States. So that's the way that... let me now take the United States as an example of a liberal democracy and see how the United States treats diversity as a liberal democracy. One, the settlement of the Europeans and what became the United States, they encounter the native population. The native population was very different from the European settlers. So what they did with this diversity, they used simply genocide to get rid of the natives. Now, this genocide mostly was achieved by contracting the native population with European disease that the natives were not immunized to. So most of the natives simply were they disappeared by diseases. But also starvation they used. They used firearms and so forth to get rid of the population. And this way, really, they reduced the diversity in New America. Now, but they imported slaves, African slaves. So how then there was a diversity? They from different languages and so forth. They assimilated them culturally. They Christianized them. They taught them the English language and so forth. But what the way really they did, they reduce diversity by subordinating them, by marginalizing them, so the diversity will not affect the society and the state. So that's another way of curbing or containing diversity, by subordinating a group so that will not, that its culture or its language will not be in the public domain. Now, about immigrants. United States is a site, it's a state of immigrants. So how then immigrants can come from everywhere. They can come from Asia, from Australia, from many places. But if you look at the history of the United States, you see that till 1965, the United States used ethnic quota. They give very high quota to Europeans, and very low quota to other people, especially Asians, far Asians, Chinese and Japanese and so forth. They didn't let them come. They came in very, very small numbers because there were ethnic quota, so they don't let them come. So the dominant group, the Anglo-Saxon group, imposed its language, its culture, its legal code, and using mostly public schools to do that. But one other way of you achieve reduction or elimination of diversity, not only by what you do. The other way, which is a very important way, is by omission. by not doing, by denying the ethnic groups collective rights. You don't give them the right to establish their own schools with the state funds. If you deny a group to have its own schools in its language and culture, then the group cannot simply sustain its identity and its separate existence. So in liberal democracies, they give individual rights, so people can have personal autonomy, individualism, but they do not provide ethnic groups with collective rights, with autonomy, with cultural autonomy, with schools and separate civil society, with the support or funding of the state. This is what happened also in the United States. But in the 60s, what we have in the United States, a number of social movements which protested and opposed this the idea and the policy of assimilation. We have the civil rights movement, we have the white ethnic, what we call white ethnic non-Anglo-Saxons, like Polish, Italians, and so forth. We have the Black Power movement, we have the feminist movement, we have the UH movement, all kinds of movement in the 60s in the United States which oppose assimilation. And then the United States has to cope with this new protest, a new opposition to assimilation. And what they did. So the United States had to open up culturally and maybe linguistically to this challenge of the population, not only of its own population, which doesn't want to be fully assimilated, but also by the new immigration, mostly of Latins, of Mexicans, of Colombians, of all people from Latin America, which were not very fond of being assimilated. So, and then you can say that the United States has become multicultural since the 70s. Okay. Now, first, let's see in what way they become multicultural. One way is they change the concept of assimilation. Before that, the expectation was you will have instant assimilation. You have complete assimilation. Like you have no leeway what to do. Now, they are more tolerant about the pace of assimilation. And also they give you some control over the process of assimilation. You can decide in what area you assimilate and what area you later assimilate. You decide about if you do it in this generation, maybe some of this will be in the next generation. So you have some control. I call it self-customization of the process. So you have some control over that. So what happened then over the years? A lot of Americans also had some control about their identity. And they choose more and more hyphenated identity. You are Black American, you are Polish American, Italian American, Black Americans, and so forth. So this is, I mean, there was some diversity which was accepted by the American system. But when you look in depth about this multiculturalism in the U.S., you see most of it. It's really not differences in culture or difference in ethnicity and celebration of all these differences. It's really about inclusion. I mean, they accept you as a Black. There will be no discrimination against you as a Black as long as you behave like us, as long as you do not emphasize the differences. So the idea is not really multiculturalism. I call it multi-subculturalism. So it's not acceptance of multiplicity of cultures, but of subcultures, variations of the same of the same culture. So let's see now what then this. There is some advances of multiculturalism in the U.S., but also there were some limits of multiculturalism. With all the changes that the United States has adopted, it continued not to recognize ethnic groups, not to grant collective rights to non-assimilable minorities. Don't recognize you. They don't recognize other language. Now, if you look at the United States today, with all the celebration of multiculturalism, all the 50 states of the United States, all of them are administrative units. None of them is based on language, on lingual differences, none of them on differences of culture, and so forth. All of them simply for the simplicity and of bureaucracy. You know, it's not like, say, the Soviet Union, which was based on language and nationality. It's not like in India and then we'll talk about a bit on Switzerland, which is based on language and so forth. And the best example I can bring about the limits of linguistic and cultural and ethnic differences in the United States is the question of Puerto Rico. You know, Puerto Rico was occupied by the United States by the end of the 19th century. It's almost now 120 years that this is a kind of possession of the United States. And they cannot solve the problem of Puerto Rico. There are two ways to solve the problem of Puerto Rico. One is to make it independent state, sovereign state, separate from the United States. And the other way is to incorporate it as the 51 state of the United States. Now, the Puerto Ricans do not want to be independent, but also they don't want to give up their language and culture, because the American Congress says to them, if you want to be 51 state, it's okay, but you have to give up your language. You can have only English-speaking Puerto Rico. So you can see that multiculturalism in the United States is really quite limited. There is no real shift toward the other type of political system, what we call consociational system. Now, what does it teach us about Europe? I mean, talking about the United States with the limits of multiculturalism, I think all these limits of multiculturalism in the United States apply to Europe, and even more so to Europe. Because in Europe, Europe is more homogeneous ethnically than the United States. The United States is a country of immigration. If it's a country of immigration, you expect more differences. In Europe, it's not. It's really used to be immigration, but the new immigration, which really challenging it, and so in Europe, I think the problem is severer than in the United States. And let me finish this part by saying that now there is a new consciousness arising in Europe, which talk about cultural rights of the majority. All the time we are talking about cultural rights of the minority. This is liberal theory, you know, that the minorities are vulnerable, you have to defend the minorities, and they have their own rights, and so forth. And now they are also talking about the right of majorities. The right of majorities to defend the nation, to defend their language, to defend their culture, to defend their public domain. They are used to public domain and they want to keep it. And how they do it? They have the right to keep, to control immigration. So they don't want to have some immigrants who can change the public domain and the language and so forth. So I think the new immigration to Europe especially the Muslim immigration, is experienced as a threat to the dominant culture and language and the public space. Now, let's move to the constitutional democracies, those democracies which are not liberal, but they are concessional in the sense these are political systems which accept the public differences, the cultural differences. Now, why they accept the public, the cultural differences or the ethnic differences? I mean, historically, I said, you know, they are also liberal and they're also national and so forth. Why they accepted it? They accepted it because they had no choice. I mean, the majority was not strong enough to subordinate the minority, or the minority was strong enough not to submit to the majority. And for this reason, that they had no choice but to accommodate by accepting the differences. Why? This is because maybe the minority is too large, as in the case of Belgium, or the minority has some support from the outside, like in Macedonia, or because of the wars, for centuries of wars in Switzerland, and they had no choice only to go this way. Now, let's see now what's the difference then between liberal democracies and constitutional democracies as far as the multiculturalism is concerned. In constitutional democracies, you recognize the minorities. You recognize them, you recognize the language, you recognize the culture, you recognize the ethnicity of the other minorities. And not only you recognize them, you grant them collective rights. You give them the right to keep their language and their culture and their separate schools, and you fund it. You just say, I recognize you. You fund the differences so they can go on. So really we are talking here on multiculturalism, which is much more sustainable and genuine. Now, not genuine because they like the differences, but they tolerate the differences, and they have it for a greater time. Now, how they do it, constitutional democracy, how they keep these differences and manage them. One, not only recognition they have and giving collective rights, but also they will have separate institutions, separate schools, separate civil society, and so forth. So we are talking about in constitutional democracy on separate but equal. All the time we say, if they are separate, they are not equal. No, in constitutional democracies, they are separate and equal. So they give autonomy, self-rule, that every minority has control of its own institution. They will distribute resources proportionally according to the size of the minority, the state budget, the positions in society, and so forth. They share power at the level of government, parliament and government. And they have also veto power of the minority. They will not make any decisions which hurt the vital interest of the minority. How I am doing?
You've got another 5 to 10 minutes.
5 to 10 minutes, so I'm going to run. Okay, Switzerland is one of the cases, maybe very successful case, and you can see how it works in constitutionalism work in Switzerland. So this is, they have three groups, Germans, French, and Italian. They have a confederation. This is the cantons. They have 26 and 5 cantons. Each canton is autonomous. The canton can decide the language and the religion of the canton. And there is a confederation in which all the languages, linguistic languages, are represented. Now, there is distribution of power and resources between all the three groups. They share power in the government. They have 6 cabinet ministers, 3 Germans, 2 French, and 1 Italian. And they do all kinds of compromises. But what's interesting about Switzerland, and this is about diversity, said, look, it's very hard to work, to live with diversity. When you look at Switzerland at the top level, it's very heterogeneous, it's very diverse. You have three languages and three groups and so forth. Now, you go down to the canton. Now, the cantons, most of the cantons are unilingual. Most of the cantons have just one religion. Now, if you go down to the district, you have even more uniformity. But people don't live in the cantons. They live in a community. They live in the commune. And the commune is completely uniform, ethnically and linguistically and so forth. So you have in this constitutional democracy, it's a mix of heterogeneity only at the top, but it's uniformity and lack of diversity in the lower position where people live. Now, one word about ethnic democracies, and I will, in 5 minutes, I finish. Ethnic democracy is a hybrid political system in which there is extension of civil rights to all, but at the same time, the ethnic majority owns the society, is in control of the system, and imposes its language and its culture and everything else. But in addition, because there are minorities with different language and different culture and so forth, and the minority is not assimilable, so they have to live with this with the minority. And the way they do it, the kind of subordination and collective rights. I mean, let the minority keep its language and culture. Now, Estonia is one of the examples of this countries. The Estonian people is very small, a small nation. It's 1 million people, that's all. And they have a minority of Russians, about Russian speakers of a third of the population. And the Estonian feel that they are under threat of extinction of a people. Their people might simply disappear. So they use the state as a vehicle to preserve the Estonian people, so they impose their language, their culture, their symbol, everything is Estonian. Like there were no Russians in the country. And they also deny, half of the Russians are denied citizenship because they arrived after 1940 and they were like some kind of settlers. But at the same time, there is a rule in Estonia that if there is a concentration of people in an area with 20% of them speaking a different language, they don't say Russian, they say different language, then they have the right to use this language and they in their schools and their municipalities and so forth. So there is some recognition, but indirect recognition of these people. So this kind of subordination and acceptance, which helps to this system. Let me just now conclude. What is really my message? My message is that the West, if you see their historical record, the West has done all it can to get rid of diversity, ethnic and cultural and linguistic differences, and it was quite successful. Historically, they are quite successful, and use all kinds of ways, voluntary and involuntary ways, coercive and non-coercive ways, to achieve these goals. And then there came a new immigration, which is not assimilable, which is also threatened also because they think it's connected also with an enemy, you know, or it can change the whole structure of society and culture and so forth. So the West has done some concessions, but hasn't changed its political system from a system of liberal democracy to a system of constitutional democracy. There were some changes within the liberal system, and I don't expect the West to continue this process, because we're already experiencing a backlash against the new immigration. There is always a threat that of this people, and also there is a rise of this new consciousness that as the majority also has rights, not only the minority, but also the majority has rights. And let me finish with just where I start. I think what we learn from Anthony, that nationalism is not going away. So we are at a stage where we see rising of nationalism to counteract this new wave of immigration and new challenge of diversity. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Professor Smuha, for that very stimulating, depressing lecture. we are open to questions. Oh, Lord, yes. Do we have a microphone anywhere? Yeah? Can we... a couple of people there. Perhaps we can take three or four at a time.
So maybe you can get the name so I can...
Okay.
Hi, Professor Smuha. Thank you very much for that lecture. I guess I was perhaps hoping to hear a little bit of a, let's just say, a value judgment from you, perhaps, on because you've described quite well, some measures by which states do, make attempts to, consolidate their own identities and deal with diversity. But I mean, and of course, I mean, states are, different states have different playbooks. I understand that. But I mean, what do you think are maybe, I guess, normatively or ethically, morally, some boundaries that states in trying to deal with these these questions of diversity should deal with? For example, I mean, as you say, in an ethnic democracy, is it acceptable to limit minority rights in the interest of consolidating rights for a majority? Is that ethically where can we draw lines? I'd like maybe just if you could expand on that a little bit more.
Perhaps we could have another question,
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Smuha. It's wonderful to get a chance to listen to your lecture. You spent some time talking about the mechanisms by which consociational democracies institutionalize difference. And in some countries, Canada, Belgium, Switzerland, these countries have used consociationalism to deal with, the diversities that existed in those countries many, many years ago. But now countries, consociational democracies, are dealing with a new wave of different kinds of peoples. Let's use the example of, as you said, immigrants from Muslim-majority countries. Do you see the consociational democracies going through another bit of institutional changes? And likewise, the example of Switzerland, where diversity is so geographically focused, and how immigration from Muslim-majority countries is likely not to be along sort of regions of Switzerland. For example, how would Switzerland sort of adjust its model of dealing with diversity in a consociational manner? Thank you.
Okay, well, perhaps there's a lot in that. Perhaps you answer those two, and then we'll pick up some further questions. Yeah.
Okay, I'm a social scientist, I'm not a philosopher, but I'm also an intellectual, so the question is really of what the ethics, of diversity and how you, ethically or morally, how you do it. I think you should ask the question about the right of majorities. Do the majorities have right, not only the minorities? And that's really the very challenging question. I don't think there is an answer yes and no. Or do they have right, do not have right? Depends which right, what right, and what they do. So I think you have to go into details. I mean, the answer should be in details. Rather than to say, yes, they have rights, you know, and, oh, I mean, majorities have rights, for example, to control immigration. I mean, it's not there. If Germany is not an immigrant country or Britain is not an immigrant country, they have the right to control immigration. But once the immigrants are in, you have to treat them equally. You have to respect their differences. And you respect their differences, again, depends to how, to what extent. I mean, for example, doesn't bother me, say, in Paris, that Muslim women go with burqa. I mean, I don't think this is should be a big issue. But it's a big issue, it will be a big issue, if they will say, we want public schools in Arabic. That's okay, they can have public school in Arabic, but they can finance this in, you know, communally. But the state will have it, you know, for them? I don't know. I mean, it's very problematic. Now, let me give you another example. The teaching of what we call core subjects in schools, you know, subjects which, like mathematics, like language, you know, all, these are the basic. There are some schools which do not teach, you know, I mean, religious schools or communal schools and so forth. I think the state has the power, not only the power, the right to impose on these communities what we call illiberal communities, they have a different set of values, on them to teach in this in their schools, and public schools in their schools, to teach all these core subjects. So what I'm saying, I'm not giving you any answer, yes and no. I'm saying that we have to have a discussion. We have to have negotiation with the minorities. We have to have dialogue, and we have to sort out these differences. Now, the question about how constitutional democracies are coping or with immigrants. Now, constitutional democracies are not that stable because they are built on demographic, there is demographic ratios between the ethnic groups or linguistic groups, and they distribute resources according to the to the size of the groups. Now, if you have a new immigrant, you have a problem. How do you count them? Suppose these immigrants will increase one of the constituent linguistic groups in Switzerland. For a long time in Switzerland, they don't want immigrants. They want immigrants only as foreigners, but not to be citizens and so forth. Will the new immigrants will be a fourth group in the society, and they will have also some representation? So that is, I think, the vulnerability of constitutional democracies to any change of the demography of the state, change by the newcomers, and so forth. And again, it's very difficult for them, and we know it's very difficult for Switzerland.
Ah, I saw a couple of, yes, there are a lot of hands up.
Maybe I have to give short answers.
Yeah, I want to, yeah, I'll take four people. I've got Montserrat and then, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you very much. First of all, I would like to thank you for giving an excellent lecture. It's been a pleasure, real pleasure, listening to you and learning from you. So thanks for the treat tonight. I'm sure that Anthony would be really delighted with what has been said and the way in which you present it and we responded to it anyway. My questions are very short. All that we are talking about, it seems to me that we are talking about power. power is the key issue in here. And for me, the question is, who decides? I would like to hear from you on this. Who decides? And the second question I would like to ask is, in your view, what are the prospects for the future? Not generic, not everything. Just pick up, if it's possible, one specific point. Thank you.
Okay, I'll take four. It was going to be very, very difficult. John Brogan,
My question is about this ethnic majority. Is that a misleading phrase? When one thinks of the transformations that have taken place in what we call nation states, just in the most general terms, English to British, Anglo-Saxon to take on board Italians, Poles, Swedes, and so on. Even in non-democratic societies, it's been argued by some people that Han is many ways a construct, that Han Chinese were not ethnically a majority in 1900, that they are themselves constantly being constructed. In order, in many ways, to stay as a majority, they have to keep changing their own definition. So I'm just a bit concerned about the use of the term ethnic to describe the relationships between majority and minority. It seems to be a word that they use, but it's not necessarily a word a social scientist should use, possibly.
Okay, this gentleman over here.
On your
short question too,
on your last two points on the screen, you seem to be saying that the West will continue the sort of post-1945 consensus, but say the right-wing populist parties like the National Front in France, their sort of rhetoric is to change this. So do you think if they did take power, they wouldn't be able to change the sort of liberal, democratic, or at least, you know, consensus, or that they would be able to?
I didn't get it, I'm sorry. Can you explain to me? What did he say? What is the question? What was the question?
Shall I repeat?
Would the National Front be able to transform liberal democracies?
If he's saying it will continue as it has been committed to liberalism democracy in the West, but if a populist right party did take power, would they be able to change that?
A fourth one here, yes.
Is it becoming harder for liberal democracies to assimilate minority groups for three reasons? First of all, the scale of immigration, which by my calculation, say in the UK, circa 2000, is at about 70 times the level it was in, say, 1900. So the scale. Secondly, the fact of globalization, the ability of minorities to and fro rather than to cut themselves off from their roots. So never truly to assimilate or relocate. And thirdly, the extent of the difference, cultural, religious, even racial, between those who are entering now as opposed to in the past. Does all of that make the challenge of assimilation more difficult for liberal democracies?
Yeah. Okay, I think that's enough.
I'll start with the last question. Of course, all these three parameters that you mentioned are very important, and I think they'll be taken into consideration in control of immigrants, which immigrant groups you will accept, what will be the quotas, and so forth. They will do it maybe not officially, but maybe also implicitly and unofficially. Of course, because I think the new consciousness in Europe will be really the majority rights. Majority rights, not minority rights. Minority rights will continue. That's not something that they will drop. But they will try to balance minority rights with majority rights. And the idea of majority rights is new. And this is majority rights. Now this is for another question. Has to do also with the far political rights, with the radical right. Because who is really talking substantially about majority rights? This is the political right, the radical political right. This is what I'm saying. Saying we are under threat. These people are coming, and they are taking our jobs. These people are coming, and they are not learning their language. They keep their religion, and their religion is against our basic values, and so on and so forth. So also we have a right to keep our public space and to keep our education and language and so forth, and the numbers are important. You know, how many you can accommodate without changing your dominant culture. So I think all these questions will come up to the public domain, to the public discussion and discourse. Now, the question is about, I'm going from the last to the last question and in the reverse order. The question is, the question of ethnic majority. Is there such a concept, ethnic majority? If you take the ethnic majority, say, in the United States, are they really Anglo-Saxons? No, they are not Anglo-Saxon. But the core is Anglo-Saxons. The founder of this group was Anglo-Saxons. They absorbed many others. They absorbed Italians with the job on what we call white ethnics. They absorbed. And now they have even absorbing. No, blacks, they don't absorb. Because if you are a black, you know, like Obama, you know, it's intermarried and something, you remain black. So that's in the United States. But if you are from different countries, you know, not Anglo-Saxon, you're Polish or Italian, whatever, they will absorb you. And then you become Anglo-Saxon. Now they are absorbing Jews in large numbers in the United States. They are not Anglo-Saxon, but they are, now they are Anglo-Saxons. So this is one also one advantage or one reason for the power of the dominant group. That's the ability to absorb, to assimilate, to open up. So you have a new blood, a new people coming, and then. That you keep their your numbers or your majority. Now, who decides? The citizens decide. I mean, there is in democracy you have demos, you have people who all the citizens who are the sovereign. They choose the parliament, they choose the government, they choose the rulers. In procedural and liberal democracies, you choose the people who rules you. You choose a majority for the next until the next election, right? I think the citizens have the right to choose. Also, has a lot to do with power, of course. I said, why you have constitutional democracies to begin with? Because the power of the dominant group was not strong enough to submit the minority. The minority has enough power to disrupt the system. So you have to live with them. You have to make concessions to them. That's the way. So power, always we're talking about power relations. I think I answered all these questions.
Yeah. Okay. We'll take another round. Yes.
Okay.
I think we haven't had anyone from over this side, so I better, yeah. Daphne, do you want to? Yeah. Here we are.
Yeah, can you hear me? Thank you very much for your talk. I have a political science question for you then. Or rather three interrelated questions.
Oh, short.
Very short, indeed. So, the first one is, you identify three types of democracies, and then you find a way that each one deals with diversity. But how do you, in your framework, how you deal with the question of endogeneity, since the reason that they are how you defined is, so for example, consociational democracies, why did they become consociational democracies in the first place, if not because of the way that they have dealt with diversity? So I wonder if there is a circular reasoning there. Secondly, how does your framework account for variations within each category? So liberal democracies, for example, you talked about the West, but different countries deal with diversity very differently. So the US, France, the UK, Italy, Scandinavia, Spain. These are very, very different countries. How do you explain variation within cases and within time as well?
I think that's enough. Those two questions are enough, yeah. Over here.
I'll take you a little bit out of the liberal democracy and with the liberal democracies and authoritarian European countries, for example, why do you think the USSR, Yugoslavia, and Czechoslovakia failed as a state and disintegrated? Is it because of the failure of the political ideology, or there was a flawed interpretation of diversity and pluralism?
You had your hand up. Yes, please.
Thank you for the talk. I am an immigrant in the Mediterranean island of Malta, and I'm much less likely to learn Maltese than, for example, recent Syrian immigrants or any Arabic speakers. And it seems that the language is not exactly the issue, not what triggers this imagination, what you were talking about assimilability of minorities. And then when you mentioned Estonia, I thought perhaps it would be time to introduce the question of colonialism into this picture. And I wonder if you agree that some of the differences can be explained, whether these countries have been colonizers or colonized or neither.
Okay. I think I better leave you to answer these questions.
I am asked, how come that you have constitutional democracies? I mean, what are the causes for the emergence? I said, the causes for me, it has to do with power. I mean, not because of ideology. There, you had some differences, and people like the differences, and they want to preserve these differences. I don't think so. But, you know, I mean, you have to do also historical study of each case and see what were the reasons. Never you have one reason. I mean, always you have a combination of reasons to explain development of society or any particular institution. But I think the most important reason that the minority, because of its size or because of organization or because it's so much commitment to its language and culture and so forth, was strong enough to resist assimilation, to resist subordination by the dominant group. And then they did calculation. If we continue, there will be violent conflict, we have disorder and so forth. Maybe it's better to do a deal where we can live together. You know, you take Northern Ireland. I mean, it's not far. I mean, I went for, you know, in the Ireland, the question is for 800 years. I mean, colonialism, British colonialism in Ireland for 800 years. That's the oldest colonialism, you know, case of colonialism. So now you ask me about differences between liberal democracies. Of course there are differences. I mean, in such a talk I have to, you know, to generalize, I mean, and to ignore differences. I mean, there is difference between France, for example, with other liberal democracies. France is against, officially, that's the only, I think, country in the West which is officially against multiculturalism. All the other liberal democracies in the West are officially, you know, I mean, for multicultural, you're using this word, what they mean exactly, what it is, and so forth. But France is against it. It did not even sign the convention on minority rights and all this stuff. They didn't write. They said, we are against. So there are differences, of course, between liberal democracies. Now, the question about Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia, did they break up, break down because of diversity? They break up, I don't think because of diversity, but diversity helped them then to break into national units. They break up because of nationalism. Nationalism under the Soviet Union, and Yugoslavia was friend to the Soviet Union, was suppressed and was given within a federation. Once the Soviet Union's power is out, then they broke away. The same with Czechoslovakia. Now, if you go to the record, if you just review the record of Czechoslovakia, you see that the Slovaks, for hundreds of years, they were subjugated, they were subordinated to other people, to the Hungarians and to the Czech and so forth. And then, with the age of nationalism, where they can fulfill their drive to nationalism, they initiated the breakup. Then the question was, if the immigrants present a problem of linguistic diversity, or there are other factors. It's not only linguistic diversity, of course, the other things. And the problem, I think, in the West, in Europe, is Islam. I mean, that's the way it's perceived as Islam. Islam gives both. Gives a very strong religious identity, which is also ethnic. Now, Muslims in Europe, they come from different countries, so they have different ethnicities, but the common denominator is Muslim or Islamic identity. And Islamic identity dictates some kind of way of life, and also it is a barrier to assimilation. That's the problem. And now the other problem is that there are few, not many Muslims, which are, in one way or another, they are associated with the enemy, with ISIS, with whatever, you know, with the enemy of the West. And you don't need that the whole community or most of the people will be subversive. You don't need. You need enough, few people, or not just a few, but, you know, sufficient cases that they are associated with the enemy, then the whole group is associated with the enemy. Now, if you are not assimilable and you don't have liberal values, and you are associated with the enemy, you are a threat. And the threat justifies majority rights. And then you say, okay, now we can control immigration. We have to stop immigration from Muslim countries. Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry, we have to end now. We could take another 30 or 40 questions, and I'm sorry to exclude some.
I am here.
but I think it's a testimony to the stimulation of the lecture that we've had such a vibrant response. It's just my task now to ask you to thank Professor Smuha for his enormously stimulating lecture. And I'd also like to thank Emma Rees from the Government Department for her organization of the event. So thank you very much.